This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Rashid Khalidi on his new book.
It's called The 100 Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance from 1917 to 2017. This is the best book on the subject. It's an instant classic. We urge people to read it and to listen in on this great interview.
We follow up on the case of the Venezuelan embassy protectors in Washington, D.C. They could face fines and prison.
They were arrested and 2 weeks ago tried. The jury was so confused, the judge had to say it was a mistrial. Will they be tried again? Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
There's been a century of war on Palestinians by Zionists, whose goal was to establish a Jewish state on their land. More than 100 years ago, a Zionist Congress, meeting in Vienna, sent a delegation of several rabbis to Palestine to report back on what they saw. The rabbis telegraphed, quote, "The bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man." That is to say, Palestine was already settled by Palestinians, who have been there for centuries. Thus, the project of the Zionists was to ethnically cleanse Palestine by any means necessary. It has taken 100 years and 6 declarations of war, and the settler colonial project of the Zionists has been largely successful so far. 3 years ago, President Donald Trump put his young son-in-law, Jared Kushner, in charge of American policy towards the Palestinians. Without consulting them, last month, Trump announced what he called, quote, "the deal of the century." The deal gave Israel large parts of the West Bank of the Jordan River, which embraced territory illegally conquered by Israel in the war they started in 1967, and where 600,000 Israelis have been settled since then. The Palestinians were given several non-contiguous enclaves in the West Bank, plus the Gaza Strip, and told that those were displaced in 1947-1948 war and the 1967 war could never come back to the land the Zionists claim was given to their ancestors by a god thousands of years ago. They were told that they have 4 years to accept the offer. We speak today with Professor Rashid Khalidi about his just-published landmark history, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. Rashid Khalidi is the author of 7 books. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, and the Chicago Tribune. He's the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York and the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies.
Rashid Khalidi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
What were the objectives of the Zionists at the turn of the last century? And if you could, please talk about the letter your great-great-great-uncle, Yusuf Deya, the mayor of Jerusalem, aimed at Theodore Herzl, the father of Zionism. You wrote that, quote, Palestine was already inhabited.
Right. Well, he wrote that, actually, to Herzl, precisely. Well, the objective was something that Yusuf Deya realized was unrealizable without a great deal of suffering. And the objective was to create a Jewish state with sovereignty and control over immigration in a land that, as he wrote to Herzl, was already occupied, and whose inhabitants would resist being supplanted, which, of course, describes precisely what's happened over the past century. So those were their objectives. He wrote to Herzl saying to him at the end of this passage, for the sake of God, let Palestine be left alone. And Herzl, interestingly, responded to him but ignored all of the essential points that Yusuf Deya Khalidi had made.
To further their objectives, the Zionist colonizers got help from the British Empire, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. I say in the book that the Zionist movement originally was a settler colonial movement in search of a metropolitan power. And Herzl tried with the Germans, with the German Kaiser, tried with the Ottomans, tried with the French. Finally, Chaim Weizmann succeeded with the British. And the British, in the Balfour Declaration and later in the Mandate for Palestine, said that Palestine was to become a national home for the Jewish people. And in the mandate, they laid out an extraordinary number of measures that Britain was to take and took to build up a state, a Paris state, for this Zionist movement, while at the same time preventing the Palestinians from the great majority of the population, in 1917, 94% of the population, from having any national or political rights. So this was the unequal situation in which the Palestinians found themselves once the British occupied the country, starting in 1917.
What's the Trump administration's plan for the Palestinians? Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner have called their plan the deal of the century. Palestinian supporter attorney Noura Arakat said that, quote, they want to put us in permanent high-tech cages and call it peace. Is it a plan to consolidate Israel's colonial takings?
Short answer is yes, Michael. It is exactly that, and it is what Noura called it. And this is not exactly something new. This has been more or less the plan from the beginning, to get as many Palestinians out. Herzl said, we'll spirit them across the borders in his diaries. In 1948, there was a major bout of ethnic cleansing. More than two-thirds of the Palestinian people were driven from their homes or fled in terror. Most of them before the State of Israel, not most of them, but almost half of them before the State of Israel was even established while the British were still there, and the rest afterwards during the war with the Arab states. And I would argue that this plan exactly fits templates that we can see in early Zionist thinking, that we can see in Likud party thinking. If you go back and read the Likud party platform of 1977, it says exactly what the Kushner plan says. There will be one sovereignty, there will be one state, there will be one security authority between the Mediterranean and the river. There will never be a Palestinian state. Israel will control all of Jerusalem. These are objectives that have been sought over many, many decades. And while they were aspirations of governments of Israel, they have now become the policy of the United States. That's what has changed. The United States has tacitly supported these things by funding a settlement, by supporting the suppression of the Palestinians. But now the United States has publicly come out in the Trump plan in support of these maximalist objectives.
So does the deal of the century sustain the one-state reality that exists on the ground?
I think it's meant to cement that. I think it's meant to do precisely that. That is to say, there is only one people with a right of self-determination in this country. It's the Jewish people. There's only one state here. It's Israel. And that's to say, in the entirety of the territory of old mandatory Palestine, what Israelis would call Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, what we call Palestine, in the entirety of that territory, there is only one state, one sovereignty, one security authority, and that is an Israeli state in which only Jews have certain rights, and others have either no rights or limited rights.
Amy Klobuchar, when interviewed by the editorial board of the New York Times for their possible endorsement, said she would keep the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem and would work to restart the two-state solution. What do you think about that?
Well, she said a number of other things that are very disturbing as well as that. And I think that we're seeing a struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party between people who I think are in line with the overwhelming majority of the base of that party in wanting a more balanced and equitable American position, and those who are in line with the position of the traditional democratic leadership of the party, which is whatever Israel wants, it gets. And we are 100% with Israel, whatever it does, whatever it says. And if we bleat the occasional dissent, we will continue to fund whatever Israel does. And I think Klobuchar is very much in line, and a couple of other of the candidates for the presidency on the Democratic side are completely in line with that position. Others, like Bernie Sanders, have dissented from that position.
Why did the Wall Street Journal kill your book excerpt that they were planning on running? Tell us about the excerpt, please.
Right. To our great surprise, my editor told me that the Wall Street Journal wanted to publish an excerpt from my book. And they said, the Murdoch Press is going to publish something by me? It was inconceivable. I'll tell you a little anecdote from London. My publisher in London said to me, the Sunday Times and the Times have told her, don't send us any books on Palestine. We are not allowed to review those books. So that's the Murdoch Press. The Sunday Times, of course, and The Sun and a lot of other trashy papers in England are owned by Murdoch, as are The Post and other trashy papers here. The Wall Street Journal being an excellent paper journalistically, but the most right-wing paper on earth otherwise. So they said they were going to publish it. They said they would pay the publisher and me for that excerpt. We agreed on an excerpt. The editor of the Culture page, who I happen to know, was in touch with me a couple days before publication, which was scheduled for January 28th, which happens to also be the date that Trump announced his so-called peace plan, and said to me, can you update it a little bit so it can be more in tune with the news? So I did that. And I wrote him the day before it was supposed to appear to say, can you tell me when exactly it's going to come out? And he wrote back to me saying, I have some bad news. And what they claimed was that the op-ed people are completely separate from the culture page, but the culture page has to be connected with the news people. And they said that my excerpt was too close to some things at the news page. Well, obviously there was political intervention from the highest levels. The person who had been in touch with me, I think, was embarrassed, rightly so. He had been the one who wanted to publish it. I said to myself, I'll believe it the day that I see it in print. And of course, it never did appear. And so my editor sent it to The Intercept, who published it with a lovely comment by The Wall Street Journal.
Just as an aside, I co-edited a book called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Mm-hmm. And the co-editor, along with my wife Debbie, was Frances Golden. And she insisted that we not use a small left-wing publisher, that we try to get one of the major houses. Mm-hmm. And she got HarperCollins, which ironically is owned by Murdoch.
Precisely.
So there we were in the offices of the HarperCollins building and the corner office and the vice president's office. And I walk in. This is to negotiate the contract. And I walk in and I see on the couch, it's a huge office, one of those offices that looks like a living room. And I see on his couch a pillow with the Queen of England on the pillow. And my heart sunk. And then I looked over to the other end of the couch, and there was a pillow with a picture of Karl Marx on it.
Oh, my God. You're supposed to sit on those things.
You could sit on it. And they wound up publishing it, and they gave us a $10,000 advance.
Wow.
Who knows why?
Well, the Wall Street Journal paid me a kill fee, so, I mean, nice. I suppose I shouldn't complain.
Right.
No, you shouldn't. You should go out for dinner. We're speaking with Rashid Khalidi, whose new book, just an excellent book, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance from 1917 to 2017. Rashid, your book's divided into six chapters, mm-hmm. and each chapter describes what you call a declaration of war against Palestine. Why'd you break it up that way? Can you talk about that?
Sure. A couple things. The first thing is, what I try and argue in this book is that this war, what I describe as a war on Palestine, is that and not some tragic conflict between two equally balanced peoples with equal claims and so on and so forth. It's not equally balanced. It's enormously tilted towards one side. Why? Because the greatest imperial power of every age since 1917 has forcefully supported the Zionist project and later the State of Israel. So you're not talking about any kind of equality. You're talking about an indigenous population under attack in order to supplant it with a new population, and that's being done with external support. I break it up into six chapters because I see certain statements or declarations or international resolutions as amounting to declarations of war on the Palestinians, which are then subsequently followed by actual war on them. And so I talk about the Balfour Declaration. I talk about the Partition Resolution of 1947. I talk about UN Security Council Resolution 242 of 1967, for example, as declarations of war on the Palestinians. And I explain why. Essentially, all of these had as their objective erasing the Palestinians and replacing them with a new state, a Jewish state, later on the State of Israel.
British treated the Palestinians with the same contemptuous condescension that they lavished on other subject peoples from Hong Kong to Jamaica, you write in your book. Could you say the same thing about the USA?
Yes. Obviously, the British do it with a certain aristocratic contempt and a certain highfalutin upper-class accent. Americans do it with our flat accent, but it amounts to the same thing. The British not only treated the Palestinians with condescension and contempt, they repressed them ferociously. When the Palestinians revolted against British rule in 1936, 37, 38, 39, the British ultimately brought in over 100,000 soldiers and police and the might of the Royal Air Force. They killed, wounded, imprisoned, or exiled about 10% of the adult male population, Arab population of Palestine. They brought in one soldier or policeman for every three adult males. A huge repressive force was employed over several years to crush the Palestinians. So this was a war waged by the British Empire on the Palestinians in service of British imperial objectives, but also in service of the Zionist project. And at the same time, British officers like Ord Wingate were training, arming, and leading what were called night squads, i.e. groups of militiamen trained to enter into Arab villages, assassinate people, killing them in cold blood, blowing up their houses over their heads, and so on, teaching these militiamen what later became the methods of the Israeli army. And in fact, on the Israeli army website, it says that, you know, the spirit of Ord Wingate animates the IDF. And I think that's absolutely true. Ord Wingate is described in a book by the Israeli historian Tom Segev by his own men as a psychopath. And I think that says something.
Rashid, in 1982, you and your wife Mona and your two young daughters were working and living in Beirut when the Israeli army attacked. What was that like?
Well, we had been living in Beirut for much earlier than that, and we had been experiencing various phases of what was later called the Lebanese Civil War, though it was much more than that. It was a regional war. The PLO was involved. Syria was involved. Israel was involved. And there were also all kinds of Lebanese factions involved. So we had had a lot of experience of war, including an Israeli incursion, invasion of 1978 of the southern end of Lebanon by the time the Israelis attacked in 1982. But this was on an entirely different scale. I mean, the Israelis employed 8 or 9 divisions and the entire air force that ultimately ended up besieging West Beirut together with their right-wing Lebanese allies and with the unstinting support of the United States, which before the invasion gave a green light, as I describe in the book, to this Israeli invasion and to the aims that Israel had for its invasion. So I call it an American-Israeli war. It's not an Israeli war alone. The Israelis obviously were the ground forces and the air forces and the ships that were bombarding us, but it was bigger than that. Well, it was – I mean, anybody who's lived with children in a situation of war knows that your primary concern is keeping them safe and trying to explain to them what's going on. And we had a lot of difficulty doing that. In 1982, my youngest daughter would have been 5 years old, and Dima had her third birthday, actually, the day before the ceasefire. She was born August 11th. The ceasefire at the end of the siege was August 12th. And that was one of the worst days of bombardment. So we had her party in a day when the planes were bombing nonstop and artillery was landing and so on. We were very lucky that nothing happened to us. Unlike so many other people, 17,000 people were killed in this invasion, almost all of them civilians, and tens of thousands wounded.
Michael and I found exceptionally compelling in your book not just the history of the last 100 years of Zionist conquest of Palestine, but that you interwove stories like the one you just told about yourself and your family, which had ancient roots in Palestine. Please talk about how far back your roots are traceable and how it helped you in researching and writing your book.
Right. Well, I was actually doing research in various family libraries in Jerusalem in the early 1990s when I came across the papers of the person whose story you mentioned, Yusuf the Al-Khaldi, the guy who'd been mayor of Jerusalem and actually deputy for Jerusalem in the first Ottoman parliament of 1877-78. And I was fascinated by this person. And he was one of a line of people in my family who've been involved in various ways in either legal affairs. I mean, have many, many, many ancestors who were judges, going right back to the Mamluk dynasty in Egypt in the 14th century. And some people in the family argue we can trace our roots back further, before the Crusades, and some even argue before that. I think it can be documented to the 14th century, probably earlier, but I wouldn't stake my reputation as a historian on that. Anyway, the family has a long connection with Jerusalem, going back, you know, the better part of maybe 1,000 years, maybe more.
But your father left for the USA in 1947.
Actually, a little before that. He came here in 1939.
Ah, and he never went back. Is that true?
Oh, he did go back. He went back. I describe, in fact, a trip back with my mother after they were married in 1946-47 when he goes to visit Amir Abdullah, later King Abdullah of Transjordan. And they were planning to settle in Palestine after he finished his graduate work here. He was here to do graduate work. He got a degree at Michigan, and he was working on his PhD at Columbia when he went back in 1946-47. My grandfather's house, which is on the cover – but the ruins of which are on the cover of the book, we lost it in 1948. And so he was never able to go back, so he stayed here.
And what did he do here?
He worked for the United Nations for his whole career. He worked eventually in political and security council affairs, which gave me an amazing insight into what was going on, because I could come to his office and see what, you know, the documents that were being prepared and so on. And then I could go to the Security Council chamber in the visitors gallery and watch the proceedings whenever I was in New York, which I did, you know, as often as I could.
Well, you've been involved as a scholar and an activist your entire adult life. I was struck by the quote that you used from Edward Said, who wrote that this is a unique colonialism that we've been subjected to, where they have no use for us. The best Palestinian for them is either dead or gone. Mm-hmm. It's not that they want to exploit us or that they need to keep us there in the ways that the Algerians or the South Africans were kept as a subclass. Can you expand upon what his thinking is?
Right. Well, I mean, I quote that because it sort of summarizes something that I argue at greater length in the book, which is that, you know, Zionism has a national aspect. It's also, among other things, it's created both a national movement and a national entity, the State of Israel. Like many colonial settler projects, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, it created a new nation, a new state, a new people. But it was a colonial settler project. And what I'm arguing in the book is, yes, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. There's no contradiction between those two things. The four states that I've mentioned are examples of successful colonial settler projects. But Zionism was different in a number of respects. First of all, the people were not from the metropole. In other words, they were not French men and women coming from France to colonize a country which would be a part of France, as was the case in Algeria. Or English or Welsh or Scottish or Irish or whatever, subjects of the crown who would North America to make it part of the realm of Britain. They were a group, the Zionists were a group of people who sought to reestablish, as they saw it, Jewish sovereignty in their ancient homeland and had an objective which they got the support of external powers, Britain first, much later the United States, for their endeavor. And so it's a colonial settler movement, but like each one of them, it was unique. It had characteristics that none other has or had.
Your writing is beautiful, Rashid. We'd like it if you could read a passage from the Hundred Years' War on Palestine.
Sure, happy to do that. Maybe I'll read the first couple paragraphs, which relate to my uncle. My great-great-great uncle, of course. He wasn't my uncle. Yusuf Dia El-Khaldi. Let me read those now. For a few years during the early 1990s, I lived in Jerusalem for several weeks at a time, doing research in the private libraries of some of the city's oldest families, including my own. With my wife and children, I stayed in an apartment belonging to a Haredi family waqf, or religious endowment, in the heart of the cramped, noisy old city. From the roof of this building, there was a view of two of the greatest masterpieces of early Islamic architecture. The shiny golden Dome of the Rock was just over 300 feet away on the Haram al-Sharif. Beyond it lay the smaller silver-gray cupola of the Al-Aqsa Mosque with the Mount of Olives in the background. In other directions, one could see the old city's churches and synagogues. Just down Bab al-Silsila Street, which is the street where the library is located, just down Bab al-Silsila Street was the main building of the Khaldi Library, which was founded in 1899 by my grandfather, Hajj Raghib al-Khaldi, with a bequest from his mother, my great-grandmother, Khadija al-Khaldi. The library houses more than 1,200 manuscripts, mainly in Arabic, some in Persian and Ottoman Turkish, the oldest dating back to the early 11th century, including some 2,000 19th-century Arabic books and miscellaneous family papers, the collection is one of the most extensive in all of Palestine that is still in the hands of the original owners. At the time of my stay, the main library structure, which dates from around the 13th century, was undergoing restoration, so the contents were being stored temporarily in large cardboard boxes in a Mamluk-era building connected to our apartment by a narrow stairway. I spent over a year among those boxes, going through dusty, worm-eaten books, documents, and letters belonging to generations of Haredis, among them my great-great-great-uncle, Yusuf Dia ed-Din Pasha al-Khaldi. Through his papers, I discovered a worldly man with a broad education acquired in Jerusalem, Malta, Istanbul, and Vienna, a man who is deeply interested in comparative religion, and especially in Judaism, and who owned a number of books in European languages on this and other subjects. And as I go on to say in the book, this was the man who wrote the letter to Theodor Herzl in 1899.
Thank you for that.
That was nice. Thank you. That was Rashid Khalidi reading from his just-published book, The Hundred Years' War on Palestine.
What kind of reception, other than the Wall Street Journal, is your wonderful book getting?
Well, it's a little hard to say. It was just published a couple weeks ago, actually 2 weeks ago, almost exactly. It seems to be getting a good reception. I had a review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review, which I didn't particularly care for, by somebody who I don't think understood much of what I was trying to say. But he talked about the book at some length, and I have a feeling that, you know, any reader who is not completely blind, deaf, and dumb is going to maybe pick up the book in consequence. I've had a couple of other very nice reviews in the UK and here. I was just in Britain promoting the UK edition of the book, which is identical with a different cover. And the reception everywhere I've spoken has been wonderful. I mean, we've sold out every copy that was available at the events I've done. And the audiences were extremely enthusiastic. So far, so good. It's early days.
That's the 100 Years' War on Palestine. Rashid, your daughter, who you mentioned, had her third birthday party in the middle of a war, is now a young woman. She's an attorney. She heads up an organization called Palestine Legal. She's a friend of ours, and we've heard her often talk about the Palestinian exception to the First Amendment. And I wanted to ask you about your daughter's work and that exception.
Right. Well, I mean, she can speak more eloquently about these things than I can, actually. But what you realize if you speak about Palestine or you write about Palestine is that there is a ferocious objection to the very opening of the topic. And that people who are otherwise liberal and people who accept that issues of human rights and rights generally should be debated and discussed close down where Palestine is concerned. And there is a chilling willingness to shut down freedom of speech or academic freedom where Palestine is concerned. And this is this almost hysterical opposition to any discussion of Palestine has reached the point now where anybody who criticizes Israel or talks about Zionism or talks about abuses of Palestinian rights can be smeared as an anti-Semite. And I would argue that this is the tactic of scoundrels who can't possibly deal with the arguments being made from the other side and have to shut the debate down out of fear that they will lose any open argument over issues like what Israel does to the Palestinians or what the nature of the Israeli state is, in particular after the passage of the notorious nation state law of July 2018, which says Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people and there's only room for one people here. In the land of Eretz Israel, there is one people with a right to self-determination. What that basically says is the Palestinians don't exist here as a people. That in and of itself should be a subject of debate and discussion. And if you try and bring that up, you're, quote unquote, an anti-Semite.
And is that the product of, say, the powerful lobbyists on behalf of Israel? How did we get to this?
Well, we've gotten to this from a situation where there was no voice that contradicted a hegemonic narrative that Zionists and later after the State of Israel was created, the State of Israel managed to fashion about Palestine. The only voice that was audible, the only voice that was heard, the only narrative that was available was one that lauded Israel and treated the Palestinians either as if they didn't exist or as if they were a bunch of savage terrorists or whatever. And what has happened over in recent years is that alternative narratives have sprung up. And the response to this, instead of, you know, getting down in the trenches and debating, which really they can't do because in many cases they have no arguments. How can you justify killing 3,000 people in Gaza when 8 Israeli civilians are killed? International law talks about something called disproportionality, and that's one of the bases for calling something a war crime. Well, if you admit that all of these facts are there and that that's what international law is, then you are in the dock. And obviously they don't want to be in the dock. They want to be the people who describe the people being killed as terrorists and describe the victims as responsible for their own deaths. So in that kind of situation, you have resort to this. And the sad thing is this is now being supported by the federal government, by an executive order issued by this man Trump in December of 2019, all kinds of things are now going to be treated as discriminatory violations of the Civil Rights Act, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and as such that various statements about Palestine or Israel can be considered, quote unquote, anti-Semitic by the government and a grounds, if they find that this is the case, in investigations that are going to be run by somebody who helped to concoct this ridiculous notion, a man named Kenneth Marcus, who's in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Education, this can lead to the withdrawal of funds from universities. So this has now become not just a right-wing campaign against people who advocate for Palestinian rights, which was the case before, a well-funded, massive international campaign. They say exactly the same things in the UK or in France or in Germany or in Israel as they're saying here. It's the same script. It is an international campaign. Now we have the federal government behind it under Trump.
I read an interesting article recently in the New York Times. A reporter did a study of textbooks in the U.S. depending on were they on the East Coast or Middle America?
Texas or, yeah.
Yes. And didn't read, but I wonder if that covers the Middle East history.
I mean, I haven't looked at the textbooks myself. I've heard about that article. I haven't seen it. But I know of cases in schools where things are being taught that are manifestly false and things that people want taught are banned because they offend people. And we have this problem on campus. People who have been brought up to believe what are manifestly falsehoods, recognized by historians from, you know, Israeli historians to everybody else, argue that their feelings are hurt if anybody contradicts the fairy tale narrative that they grew up with. And, you know, you don't – I have grandchildren. I have one who's a four-and-a-half-year-old, and he's in a wonderful daycare center in Chicago in the suburbs of Chicago. I wouldn't want my four-and-a-half-year-old grandson's feelings hurt. But undergraduate students should be exposed to all kinds of stuff, obviously not hate speech, obviously not anything that's vile or vulgar, but ideas that they might find uncomfortable are what they should be dealing with and grappling with. Of all sorts, ideas of all sorts in university, or they're not getting a proper education. If they come in here indoctrinated to universities and leave, then their parents are wasting hundreds of thousands of dollars on private education. They should just keep them home, keep the money, and leave them as ignorant and as blinded as they are when they come. And they should be exposed to different things. They can accept them or reject them as they choose.
Especially when it's proven by fact.
Right, right.
We've been talking with Rashid Khalidi about his new book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. It's an excellent book. We urge everybody to go out and get it. He talks about the history of settler colonialism and resistance from 1917 to 2017. Rashid, how can people follow your work?
I hope they buy the book. It's available in an audio version and a Kindle version, e-book version. I write a lot in various venues like the press and so on. If they're interested in hearing me, I speak in different places all over the country. I'm going to be in Detroit on the 26th of February. I'm going to be in Chicago, my heavens, I think on the 15th of April. I'll be at the University of Michigan the day after Detroit, which would probably be the 27th. In Chicago, I'll be speaking at the University of Chicago. And I probably have other speaking engagements coming up that we're still organizing. In the first instance, I hope they'll buy this book.
It's a wonderful book, and we do encourage readers.
Rashid, thank you so much for coming down to our studio and joining us today. We're very grateful for your good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you both very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
In violation of international law, in May 2019, the U.S. government attempted but failed to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. The United States had at that time attempted to install Juan Guaidó as the president of Venezuela, and Guaidó's right-wing supporters attempted to take over the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. Under international law, the embassy is the property of the Venezuelan government and is considered untouchable. A number of Americans, known as the embassy protectors, moved into the embassy to prevent its hostile takeover. The State Department, Secret Service, and the Metropolitan Police Force laid siege to the embassy. Electricity and water were cut off, and no food was allowed in. Although the coup against the Maduro government failed, the embassy protectors were arrested when the U.S. government raided the Venezuelan embassy. Four of the protectors, including today's Law and Disorder guest, attorney Kevin Zeis, were arrested and faced trial. If convicted, they could have been fined up to $250,000 and given a one-year prison term. The embassy protectors were tried 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C., and the jury was hung, so there may be another trial. Kevin Zeis is a U.S. lawyer and political activist. He helped organize the 2011 Occupy encampment in Washington, D.C. He is currently the co-director of the organization Popular Resistance. Kevin, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
We want to review a little history in case listeners forgot. Can you talk about the purpose of the U.S. instigation of a military coup against the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela?
Well, yeah. I mean, this has been a long-term effort, really. The U.S. has been trying to bring Venezuela back under control of the U.S. Domination since the election of Hugo Chavez back in 1999. And the most recent coup under the Trump administration began last January when they recognized Juan Guaido, a self-appointed president, encouraged by the Trump administration. Mike Pence talked to him the night before he announced. Donald Trump immediately recognized him as soon as he announced that he was president. And it's been a failed coup ever since. Five times they have tried over and over to remove Maduro, and Maduro has just gotten stronger. And the reason that they want to do this, I think there's several. First, of course, natural resources. Everyone knows Venezuela is number one in oil reserves in the world. They're also number one in gold and diamonds. Canada is involved, I think, because of the gold. They're a very big gold extraction country. They also have number five in gas. And I think most important to the United States, precious minerals that are used for weapons and electronics. The U.S. needs those for its war machine. The U.S. actually depends on China for some of those minerals, and so they need to get control of that. But the other thing, the major reason is Venezuela broke from U.S. domination, has become an independent and sovereign country, and the U.S. cannot stand an independent country that says it's not controlled by the United States, especially in backyard Latin America. Trump is trying to revive the Monroe Doctrine, which is the U.S. domination of Latin America, and Venezuela is the key for that domination.
Why did the coup fail?
The coup failed because Maduro and his party have been spending a lot of resources on lifting up the poorest. Even during this U.S. economic war, they've built more than 3 million social housing units for the poorest Venezuelans. With 4 people per house, that's more than 10 million people and a population of 30 million. So people know that even with this economic stress, the government is focused on lifting the poorest up. They provide food through their CLAP program to 6 million households. That's 24 million households each month at very low prices. And Maduro has solidified his support. The country is very educated on U.S. imperialism. I was amazed when I was down there the various ways the country gets educated, from television to a discussion in media, conversations and protests. It's just amazing how widespread understanding of U.S. imperialism is. So Maduro has actually gotten stronger. Every time Guaido goes out and says he wants more economic He wants military intervention by the United States. It just makes him weaker and makes Maduro stronger. So I think he's stronger now than he was when he won re-election in 2018 with 67% of the vote, five people running in an election that was monitored by more than 300 international election observers, unanimously said it met the standards of democracy under international law. I was there for that election. It was a very well-run election, and he's gotten more popular since then.
What did the embassy protectors, including you, do on the day of the attempted coup?
Well, we did it on April 10th. On April 9th, the Organization of American States, which is a very U.S.-controlled Monroe Doctrine-type organization, the OAS changed their rules to recognize Guaido on the 9th. On the 10th, we went into the embassy with other political activists, people seeking peace and justice, and we stayed for 37 days. The idea was to prevent the opposition, the pro-coup supporters, taking over that embassy. The U.S. had already handed over the U.N. missions and the two military attaché buildings to the coup plotters, and we wanted to be inside the embassy to protect the embassy, uphold international law, and stop the coup from coming into Georgetown and Washington, D.C.
Kevin, can you please describe what happened outside the embassy while you were in?
Yeah, the first few weeks were totally fine. We could go in and out with no problem. The police didn't bother us. No one bothered us. We had forums every night. 100 people come into the embassy for a forum or a cultural event. It was really an amazing moment. But about 3 weeks into the process, there was another coup attempt in Caracas on May 30th. And at the same time, the coup supporters started to surround the embassy. And as a result of that, the embassy became very dangerous. The coup supporters, the coup mob, had us under siege. They blocked food from getting in. They threatened our supporters outside. They assaulted our supporters outside. People who were assaulted were actually arrested rather than the person doing the assault. The victim of the assault was arrested. The Secret Service, which is responsible for protecting embassies, did more to work with the coup mob than to protect the embassy or protect us. They ended up turning off the electricity and the water. We gradually shrunk down to 20 people. We had 70 people staying overnight at the embassy at its peak, got down to 20 to 15 to 7, and then finally the four of us at the end on May 16th were arrested and are now facing federal charges.
You were arrested. What were you arrested for?
We were arrested, 3 days before we were arrested, we were given a trespass notice. We knew we were not trespassing because we had the permission of the Venezuelan embassy, Venezuelan government, Venezuelan embassy officials. They over and over again thanked us, gave us permission, said we had the legal protection. So we knew we were not trespassing, but they did a bait and switch on us. 3 days later, they arrested us for interfering with the protective function of the embassy. Now, we saw that embassy. We were out at the embassy, and we know it was not being protected. In fact, the State Department officials, police, were allowing it to be attacked, windows broken, unlawful entries, and doing nothing to enforce the law to protect the embassy. And so we were arrested for interfering with protective function and had our first trial last week.
Now, Kevin, at trial, what were you not allowed to say in your defense?
Well, that was one of the very strange things. One of the anomalies of U.S. law is that the president has the power to decide who is the president of another country, who is recognized by the United States as the president of the country. And that meant that the jury was told that Juan Guaido was president, even though he has not been, even for a nanosecond, the president of Venezuela. So we were not allowed to say that President Maduro was president. We could say we believed Maduro was president, but we couldn't say he actually was, even though he is. And in fact, we saw Maduro in the embassy when we were in Venezuela earlier last year. He goes to the embassy, not the embassy, he goes to the Miraflores Palace, essentially the White House of Venezuela, where the president operates and lives. We visited him in that White House. So it was pretty amazing to not be able to say that he was president. We couldn't say that we had permission of the government because the government, according to President Trump, is not the real government. We couldn't say that the fake ambassador, Carlos Vecchio, who ask the State Department to remove us is not really an ambassador, even though he has no ambassadorial power, has never issued anything to do with the ambassadorial functions. We couldn't say that the embassy was vacant. We could, there's just so much that we couldn't say that at the end of the trial, when we talked to the jurors, they told us that they were confused. They had no idea what was going on. They didn't understand why we didn't leave the embassy when the new president took power. Of course, there was never a new president who took power. That was one of the legal fictions that existed in that courtroom.
Kevin, so how did you defend yourselves?
It was very interesting. We defended ourselves. Our lawyers did a fantastic job of cross-examining the government witnesses. And the government witnesses said enough to help us. For example, the lead law enforcement agency admitted that even after April 27th, the day that Carlos Vecchio asked us to be removed, we, Margaret Flowers, one of the other four defenders, went out of the embassy, walked over to the police, introduced ourselves, explained what was going on, explained we had permission to be in the embassy, gave them our phone numbers. He gave us his phone number, and we were in communication with the lead law enforcement agent. That's not the typical illegal occupier, to go talk to the police. And then we returned to the embassy. Even though Carlos Vecchio had said we should not be in the embassy, the police allowed us to return. And so we assumed that we were doing everything legal because the police allowed us to do that. We also talked about when the trespass notice was delivered, he admitted that Margaret and I and the other defendants said that we were there legally. We were not breaking any laws. We explained that over and over to them, and they turned around and left, again, reinforcing our belief that we were there legally. Under this statute, the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that we knowingly and willfully violated the law. Willfully means a criminal intent. How can we have a criminal intent when we believed we were not breaking the law? And so we were able to get that out through the three government witnesses, all State Department and law enforcement officials. So we did not present a defense. We rested our case when the government finished, arguing that they did not meet their burden of proof. And our lawyers did an excellent job. We had four lawyers. Each brought a very different approach to it. Each did an excellent job in closing argument to raise the issue of reasonable doubt and that the belief that we were not breaking the law.
You know, when you talk about what happened, it reminds me of Franz Kafka's book, The Trial. I mean, this is a surreal situation here. Did it remind you of that as well?
Yes, it was very Kafkaesque. I heard the various witnesses being asked to tell the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And as we saw that, we realized we would have a very hard time testifying because we were not permitted to tell the whole truth. And if we were to get up there and testify, we would be avoiding legal landmines of contempt of court for violating the judge's pretrial order. And we knew that the jury would be confused if we couldn't tell the whole truth. And so it was a very difficult situation. A Kafkaesque, I think, is a very fair description. I mean, the judge was stuck in the reality of U.S. law. I mean, she didn't make it up. This has been law for since the 1930s, that the president decides who is the legal representative, the leader of a foreign government, and the courts cannot overrule that. And so she was stuck with the Trump decision that Guaido was president, even though there's a real president who's recognized by the Venezuelan Constitution, recognized by the UN, and goes to the Villa Flores palace every day. Juan Guaido has never stepped in that palace as president. So it's a very Kafkaesque thing when you're in a situation where you know the jury is being lied to and not being told the whole truth.
Kevin, do you think there will be a retrial?
We'll find out on February 28th. If you go to our Defense Committee's website, defendembassyprotectors.org, you can get updates on that. February 28th is the next court date where the prosecutors will announce their decision. If they say that there won't be a retrial, then that'll be the end of it. The interesting thing is if you look at the Department of Justice manual about whether or not to prosecute a case, if this was not a political case, there'd be no reason to prosecute us. We do not fit any of the reasons for pursuing a criminal case. So if we are prosecuted, it'd be for a political reason, not for any reason regarding violating the law.
It seems that we're witnessing a cascade of attacks on our constitutional system. The whole constitutionality of the American government is crumbling. The latest before what they did to you was the impeachment trial, where they had a trial without any witnesses and then dismissed the charges. Do you see it that way?
Well, every one of these cases is different. I mean, an impeachment trial is not a criminal trial, and that was obviously a very much a political decision. It was not. It was done by a Republican-controlled Senate, making political decisions in an election year. And you know, I think there's lots of reasons to impeach Trump. He made a lot of actions that I think are high crimes and misdemeanors. I wasn't very enthusiastic about impeaching him for not providing weapons to Ukraine to fight Russia. I mean, I think that would be a war not very fruitful for anybody. So I wasn't very enthusiastic about that. But I do think that our institutions are under attack. I think Trump is redefining the Department of Justice as a tool for his own use. You can see that in the Roger Stone case, which will be sentenced today, the way that he has injected himself into that proceeding. And so, yes, I do see lots of problems with the direction the country is going. I hope that our case, if we are not tried again, will be an example of some common sense in the Department of Justice. But if we are tried again, we will fight to seek acquittal. We did not commit any crime. We are not guilty of any crime. And we will do our best to make that clear to the jury. And if we do, I think that will be a big defeat for the Venezuelan coup. We cover this coup on our website, popularresistance.org, regularly beyond our case. There's a lot of developments always going on. So if you want to really stay on top of what's going on that, or in Bolivia, or other foreign policy and domestic issues that movements are working on, I hope you'll visit popularresistance.org.
Kevin, we just have a couple of minutes remaining. You've given the Defend Embassy website. What can listeners do to support you?
Well, on the DefendEmbassyProtectors.org website, there are some ideas the committee has come up with to support us. We were very pleased to have people in the courtroom, and they did a very good job of behaving well and showing support, and I think that is helpful. But I also hope people will watch what's being put on the Defend Embassy Protectors site and PopularResistance.org and share it on social media. The corporate media is not covering this. The corporate media has put up a wall and is refusing to cover this at all. If we had been found guilty, they probably would have covered it. But being found in mistrial, unable to be convicted, that's not something the corporate media is covering. So it's very important for people to be the media. So go to defendembassyprotectors.org and popularresistance.org, and please share articles that are relevant that you think are interesting to you and to people who you are in communication with on social media.
Well, Kevin Zeis, Heidi and I very much admire what you're doing. We're pleased to have you on Law and Disorder. We wish you all the luck in the world, and we'd like to have you come back and announce your victory if they do try to go after you, and come back and announce your victory if they don't.
A big fan of both of your work as well. You've done great work over the years, both of you, and really an honor to be on the show, so I'm happy to come back when the next chapter of this is written.
Okay, Kevin, we're thinking of you next week. Fingers crossed.
Take it easy, Kevin Zeis. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Senen Vizio by Yusef Latif, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.